You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about a frenzy of midterm political ads and the huge amounts of money being spent on them. Now it's Food Friday. For some people, it's the season of baking, which means stocking our kitchens with butter and flour and sugar. But hold on. Our next guest says we can hold the sugar and the things we might use instead of sugar and get great sweet flavors from fruits, fresh, dried, or frozen, and other ingredients. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you bake sweet treats, have you found ways to cut down on the amount of sugar or replacement sweeteners, or do what our guest does and try to use other ingredients, fruits, and other things to bring out their natural sweetness instead? Do you have questions about how to do this, maybe to make something particular that you love to make, you love to eat, but you don't want all the sugar? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brian Levy is a pastry cook and author of the cookbook Good and Sweet. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You were inspired in this mission in part by a mango. Could you share that part of the origin story?
I was. I guess about almost 8 years ago now, I was eating a really sweet mango, and it just struck me that I should be able to make a dessert out of this another sweet fruits that without having to add any extra sugar, because it was every bit as sweet as I was as I would want any dessert to be. So I thought there must be a way to make desserts out of fruit without adding sugar to them.
And I want to make it clear here, you're not just saying replace sugar with honey or maple syrup or stevia or saccharin or whatever. You're taking that category out, right? What are you turning to instead?
Yeah. So, well, I call them sweet ingredients, because I don't call my way of doing things, I don't call what I use sweeteners, because their only purpose isn't to make things sweet, but I wanted to seek out ingredients that had flavors that made sense in recipes, as well as bringing their inherent sweetness to make things. Obviously, we want desserts and things to be sweet, so we need that sweetness. But I also want the flavor that comes along with all the fruits and different kinds of flowers and nuts and things that I use.
And now, as you mentioned, Brian, this has been years in the making, and you're off the beaten path with a lot of the stuff you're doing. There have been a lot of experiments. I'm guessing there are some experiments that didn't pan out along the way.
Yeah, there were. Yeah, so it was years of experimenting. Every recipe really was like a new experiment, because I wasn't working on just like a formula that of a single replacement for sugar. Yeah, I had to approach every recipe as an experiment. And yeah, in the beginning, especially, there were things that didn't work out so well. Like, it was usually when I approached a new category of dessert, like cake or cookie, or trying meringues. Meringues were a big failure. There are some things. One of the things that I learned along the way that was that there are certain things that you should use sugar for, such as meringue. But yeah, eventually, I felt like I cracked some codes working with different kinds of ingredients and got a good collection of different categories of desserts to work out really well.
Well, let's get a taste of one of them. You've shared a few recipes with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's start off with a rosemary lemon shortbread. What goes into this? What did it take to make it work?
Well, this is one of the ingredients that was like a real revelation for me, which is freeze-dried sweet corn. So I use the things that, and in every recipe, after the head note, it has a little what makes it sweet section. So you know what's going into the recipe that is making it sweet. And for the rosemary lemon shortbread, there's freeze-dried sweet corn and date powder. Now the freeze-dried sweet corn it's really got all the flavor and sweetness of fresh summer corn on the cob, and all that flavor gets kind of concentrated when all the moisture is taken out of it through the freeze-drying process. And but all of the nutrition is left in it, and it just has a lot more corn flavor than an ingredient like cornmeal or corn flour, the kind of stuff that we use for polenta, because that's actually made with a different kind of corn that isn't as sweet or flavorful. Anyway, so when I started using freeze-dried sweet corn, that was a really great discovery for me. And then the date powder, of course, it's whole dates. It's called date sugar also, because that's probably a more marketable term, but it's not actually a distilled sugar. It's just it's whole dates that are just blended into a powder. But yeah, so it's got dates, corn, rosemary, flour, butter.
Sure.
As much as I have healthward leanings, I still use butter and flour. I have alternatives for these kinds of things, but I'm not trying to replace everything in a conventional
enough.
Recipe.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Brian Levy about his new cookbook, Good and Sweet, baking delicious sweet treats, but without adding sugar or the common sugar substitutes, trying to get the natural sweetness out of delicious ingredients, often, but not only, fruit-related ingredients. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am really interested in this because I've been sugar-free now for over 5 years. I did have a lapse where I went back to sugar for a few months, but then I stopped eating it again. I don't eat any fruit either, though. So the ingredients that I use when I bake for Christmas, and I make cookies, I make cakes, I make cheesecake, I use monk fruit, powdered monk fruit, which I get on the internet. It's not cheap, but it's a good sugar replacement from a fruit, and it has no calories and no carbohydrates. So I use that, and then I use almond flour because I don't eat carbohydrates much. But I have a cheesecake that is out of this world, and nobody knows that it has no sugar. I served it to many, many, many people. No one knows. They love it.
Rebecca,
so
thanks.
I was wondering what he thinks about that.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. I think monk fruit, that is one of the sweeteners you avoid, Brian, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, so that just wasn't the approach. That just wasn't the route I wanted to go in my... I looked at all those kinds of sweeteners, the sugar alternatives like monk fruit and stevia, erythritol, or however you pronounce that. The thing with those things was I just found that they were... I just wanted to use foods that, like... we actually know what they look like and what their flavors are and where they come from. And I was looking for more of a whole food approach. And my goal wasn't necessarily to make things free of sugar, because there is, of course, naturally occurring sugars in all these recipes. Mm-hmm. I just wanted it all to come along with something else, like all the fruit that goes into these recipes brings along with it all these nutrients, like namely fiber and vitamins and antioxidants, but all these nutrients that make the sugar, well, first of all, I yeah the more of like a in like a the philosophy kind of deal was that I just wanted it to be a kind of whole food approach. And with all those nutrients that come along with the fruits, it does change the way your body processes the sugar. So like it doesn't hit your bloodstream as quickly as a bunch of cane sugar does.
Thanks for that call. I wanted to ask, Brian, in addition to like the health benefits of, cutting back on the sugar, obviously, can you talk about the flavor benefits? We're maybe tasting those ingredients that if we used them in the first place, would have been drowned out by that, whatever, half cup of sugar.
Yeah. So like, let's say the sticky toffee pudding, which is on the cover of the book. That was one of the first things I tested, because that's just always been one of my favorite desserts. And it's just the you know, it's kind of this brown, sugary, buttery, chewy, sticky thing that you wouldn't really think of not adding sugar to, but it does, the traditional recipe does have dates in the cake. So I just really amped up those dates and they end up kind of being the star of the show. And then there are things like in a fig crumble, I use in the topping, I use dried white mulberries, which are actually a relative of the fig. So they really complement the flavor of the figs and add to it, and just have the perfect texture for the crumble topping. So it was a lot of fun discovering new ingredients that I had never used before, like the white mulberries and using things that I had used before, but in a totally different way.
We're talking to Brian Levy. It's Food Friday. His new cookbook is Good and Sweet, a book about baking with naturally sweet ingredients, often but not only, fruits in various shapes, sizes, and forms, instead of, you know, that half cup of sugar or common sugar replacements. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried doing something like this? Do you have a favorite pastry that is, you know, lower at least on the added sugar or other sweeteners? Do you have a question about how to make a particular kind of delicious treat in this way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got a few recipes from Brian, by the way, over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Brian Levy, pastry cook, author of the cookbook Good and Sweet. He's joining us for Food Friday to talk about his alternatives to using sugar in pastry making and dessert making. His challenge over the last bunch of years, not just cut out the sugar, but not just replace the sugar either. Find naturally sweet ingredients and do what we can with those flavors. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've tried something like this yourself, if you like the notion, you want his advice or inspiration to try to do something like this at home, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out another caller now. Doug is with us in Colfax. Doug, hello.
Hi. For the last few years, my wife has substituted half the sugar and pecan pie with honey from our own hives. I just wonder what your guests thought about using honey for a substitute for sugar.
Well, I love It's super locally sourced, Doug. That's fantastic. Now, Brian, I'm guessing, again, with your experiment, honey, I think, was mostly off the table. What do you think about that? And if you were tackling pecan pie, what kind of things would you try to do to make it sweet?
Yeah, so I didn't use honey in these recipes. I love honey, but it's not in terms of what it's composed of. It's not all that different from sugar, and it kind of a big thing of this was the challenge of seeing how far I could go with ingredients that weren't like near pure sugars, with which would include things like honey and maple syrup and agave nectar. When I want the like a flavor that's reminiscent of honey, I do use bee pollen in recipes in the book, which is what it sounds like. It's little pellets of pollen that are that bees collect and bring to the hive, and they kind of look like multicolored sprinkles and have a slightly sweet, but not as sweet as honey flavor. And just a nice floral honey flavor. And then I do have a pecan pie. I have a derby pie in the book, which is a pecan pie with chocolate at the bottom. And for that, like, gooey pecan pie filling, dates were really the perfect thing for that. They, you know, pureed dates are pretty much the texture and flavor of what you want that, you know, gooey filling to be. So it's mostly dates in the pecan pie.
Fantastic, Doug, and I bet you know where to find some bee pollen. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Marie joins us now in Eau Claire. Marie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Marie?
Well, I was expecting guests who are vegan, and I thought, well, what if I use some coconut milk and maybe some almond milk and some mangoes, and I think probably just those three things. I might have added sugar, but I'm not sure that I needed to. And I can't remember exactly what I did to the mango, if I just cut it into the boiling stuff or if we added it after we made the pudding, but it worked out really well. Maybe I used a little bit of tapioca balls. I should have written it down, but everybody loved it anyway.
Yeah, you should have written it down. It sounds really good to me. And the final product was a pudding, Marie, right?
It was, yeah.
Sorry, so Brian, go ahead.
Stirring it on the stove, yeah.
I was just going to say, the great thing about coconut milk, I use a lot of it in the book because it actually is sweeter than dairy milk. So it's a really helpful ingredient when you're trying to avoid adding sugar to things, because in addition to the nice subtle coconut flavor it gives, it is also fairly sweet.
All right, Marie, back to the lab and recreate that one. Thanks so much for sharing that with us today. Talking to Brian Levy on Food Friday. His new cookbook is called Good and Sweet Cooking, baking, I should say, without sugar in our desserts, but also without a lot of the stuff we would replace sugar with, getting the flavor of sweet ingredients, the fruits and more. Hey, let's check out, Brian, another recipe you shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday, the perfect currant scone. Tell us about this one.
Oh, yeah. So in the scone, really, it's just the right amount of dried currants that make up all give it all the sweetness that it needs. That's a pretty simple one to to make sweet. And then I have some variations on that recipe. I have a chestnut flour currant scone, which chestnut flour is actually pretty sweet, and so I use that in a bunch of recipes. And when you when you add that to the scones, in addition to bringing a like delicious smoky chestnut flavor, it also sweetens it up.
Let's go back to our callers. Dennis is with us in Afton, Minnesota. Dennis, hi.
Oh yeah, hi everybody. Thanks you and your guest. I mentioned I'm drying apples today, and I use them in soup. I've been doing that for quite some time, or throw them alongside of a chicken in the pan or whatever. You know, just use them anywhere. But my real question is, your guest mentioned that you have the freeze-dried corn. I wonder if you do your own freeze-drying, if you have the equipment for doing that, and where you got the equipment if you do.
Yeah, no, I don't have the equipment for that. I looked into it, and it's expensive. But the good thing is that freeze-dried fruits and vegetables seem to be popping up more and more all over the place, like at stores where, you know, from anything from a health food store to Whole Foods to Target, and Trader Joe's actually has really great prices on freeze-dried fruits. So, it's nice to hear you're drying apples, because that's a really great ingredient that I use in a lot of these recipes.
Dennis,
I do dry those on my own.
Dennis, thanks a lot. Enjoy those apples. Susie joins us now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I might have told you about this before, Rob, but I have a recipe from the Chiquita Banana Cookbook for using bananas in pumpkin pie instead of sugar.
That does ring
really
a bell, Susie.
Good.
That, and I think I said last time, that sounds really good. And bananas are also in your arsenal, Brian.
Oh, they are. I use, fresh bananas, freeze-dried bananas. I have a banana pudding, like a traditional Southern banana pudding with that you normally would use the Nilla wafers in it, but I make what I call Nana wafers. And the thing that sweetens them is I pulverize freeze-dried banana. So it's kind of like that's starchy and sweet. So it acts as kind of a flour and a sugar. And then in my pumpkin pie, I actually use to forget the last caller's name, but sorry.
Susie, yeah.
But the gentleman.
Oh yeah.
But my pumpkin pie is one thing that I use dried apples in.
Oh, awesome. Susie,
but
thanks a lot.
That banana sounds interesting.
Definitely. Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Brian, what's next in your pastry experimentation?
Well, I'm actually doing some research I'm not ready to go public with it. But I'm doing research for another cookbook.
Excellent. Well, Brian, thanks so much for sharing these recipes with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're talking to Brian Levy, pastry cook, author of the new cookbook, Good and Sweet. He joins us today to talk about that cookbook. Got recipes that substitute things like fruits and other sweet ingredients for added sugar and all of those other sweeteners that you might replace sugar with. Well, there's still time for you to do, a couple things. Let us know if you've tried things like this at home. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and share your favorites with recipes and pictures, if available, unless you're just winging it. Then you just tell us about them. And you could check out a few recipes from Brian. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. You heard about the rosemary lemon shortbread that's up there, the perfect currant scone, and there's one bonus one we didn't even get to on the air, the pistachio studded peach galette. That one sounds really good, too. I've got some frozen peaches around. That might be something I'll want to try. So check them out. Again, they're at WPR.org/Food Friday and share your own home experimentation online on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, take a look at the big issues and races a month out from the midterm election in Wisconsin with pollster Charles Franklin. That's Monday morning. Well, and tonight we've got the debate in the race for governor of Wisconsin, the Democratic incumbent, the Republican challenger debating the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate. You could hear it where? Here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also stream it live at WPR.org, the debate itself, with some analysis to follow. Then hear from Charles Franklin about how it all went and the latest in polling. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Even without a presidential election at the top of the ticket, political ad spending nationwide could reach somewhere up to around $10 billion, according to projections from the ad tracker Ad Impact Politics. By the end of July, Ad Impact said the cycle was already ahead of the historically expensive 2020 election cycle by $700 million in non-presidential ad spending. Wisconsin is front and center. The company ranks our governor's race as the most expensive general election in the country, our Senate race the fifth most expensive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about all the money going into campaigns and then into ads? Where are you running into political ads? Can you escape them? Do you think they make a difference? Do you see them influencing you or people you know? Do you think they're a waste of money? Are you just plumb sick of them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes in the laws when it comes to political donations, too? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Christina LaPlante is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW La Crosse. She focuses on American politics and political behavior, plus campaign ads and public opinion. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What is your reaction to this? We're seeing maybe a record-setting midterm election year when it comes to political ads.
Well, you know, I think we are very much on the trajectory of seeing records going to be shattered every single election. You know, ads just continue to play an even more and more powerful role each election cycle. And, you know, quite frankly, those take up the majority of the budgets for most campaigns. So not really surprising to me much at all.
Now, on the supply side, the money supply side, a couple of big Supreme Court decisions, U.S. Supreme Court, McCutcheon and Citizens United, they really loosen up the regulations, right? Do you see that being part of what's bringing more money into the system?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, when you look at the relatively loose standards of who can contribute to campaigns and the amount of money that people can contribute to campaigns, I still think that there's a long way to go in terms of having some, you know, meaningful reform, really cracking down on the, you know, role that money plays in American campaigns. And, you know, when you look at public opinion on this topic, there's an appetite for major scale reform here. People are aware of how much money is being invested into our elections to try to influence public opinion and how we think about candidates. So I think that there's still a long way to go and that there's public appetite for that.
The Supreme Court has said, though, in effect, if I hand a candidate money to run a campaign ad, that's political speech. It seems like it's hard to make any kind of changes. Or do you see room for reform, even given those past rulings?
That's a great question. I mean, really just on this topic of the extent to which, you know, as a country and as a society, you know, that we are comfortable and willing with this precedent that's being set by the courts that spending money equals free speech. And when we're talking about capital like that, where some people inherently have more of that capital than others, by virtue of those type of court precedents, we're saying that some people have more fundamental rights than others on this basis of capital and wealth and money. So I think that there's some problematic issues there that the, you know, certainly Americans need to consider the extent to which, you know, we're okay with the type of precedent that that sets.
All right, now let's get into ads. A lot of people, I think, are locked in. They're going to vote for a D or an R on the ballot. And I think if I ask anybody face-to-face, hey, do political ads sway you? I think most people would say, of course not. I'm not a sucker. They're not going to move me. Yet I'm guessing they must do something or people wouldn't keep spending money on them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a great question. You know, even in the discipline of political science, there's a lot of debate over the extent to which we believe that political ads influence voters. You've got one camp of academics that say, you know, listen, let's look at how polarized the country is. You know, we know that people are more than ever consistently voting for one party or another. They have got their vote locked in well before the election. Ads don't persuade. They don't change candidate favorability. What's the point? It's just a waste of money. But on the other hand, when we look at the research that political psychologists are doing, for example, we know that ads uniquely produce profound emotional reactions. Campaign ads uniquely scare us. They make us angry. And these emotional reactions, you know, have a huge impact on our behaviors. When we're angry, we're more likely to engage in externalized behavior. We want to express that emotion. Sometimes we want to punch things, or sometimes it makes us want to go out and vote. So when I think we really have to consider that emotional reaction, and that drives, I think, by a large amount, our willingness to turn out and vote.
Now, if you and I are running for office against each other, my ads might not say, you know, a Christina LaPlante voter is going to switch to a Rob Ferret voter. But maybe I'm hoping that they'll discourage that Christina LaPlante voter enough. They raise enough doubt that they just don't show up at the polls that day. Is that a possibility?
I think it really is a turnout game. You know, the extent to which an ad is going to persuade someone who's been a lifelong Republican or Democrat voter to switch their vote, it certainly happens. But I think the biggest thing that we need to focus on is the extent to which these messages drive people out to vote in the first place, the extent to which these messages are activating and mobilizing people. So I think if you don't have a message that's striking people, giving them a reason to turn out and vote, and that's where you're going to lose the election.
Talking to Christina LaPlante, not my political opponent, but in fact, an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse, looking at big money in the midterm elections this year. Big money equals lots of ads. You may be seeing them. Join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you're seeing. How it makes you feel. Call 800-642-1234. Rick joins us now in Rhinelander. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, actually, you stole my thunder. I'd like to reiterate. That's okay. I'd like to reiterate that, unfortunately, fear and hate are great motivators, and the people who put forth those ads know that. Quite frankly, we can see that with the Ron Johnson ads currently being run against Mandela Barnes. They have echoes of Willie Horton ads that were done in the past in presidential elections, and I find it discouraging. The other thing is that elections have consequences, and who we have on the Supreme Court has consequences, and this is a good example. That Citizens United ruling that essentially eviscerated McCain-Feingold, which was an attempt to stop this dark money, has had a profound effect on these ads and on our politics. And I think everyone should be aware that every election, and particularly every presidential election, as it affects the Supreme Court, does have an effect on all of us, and we should all be aware of that.
Rick, thanks for the call. A couple of big points there, Christina. Let's start with this first point. Rick, concerned about fear and scare tactics in ads.
I could not have said those points better myself. Absolutely. We know in political psychology, it is these fear and anger-based messages that stick with us far much more than positive messaging. And that's one thing that I see coming out of the Barnes campaign a lot more than the Johnson campaign, is this attempt to have these promotional, hopeful, positive advertisements, learning about the candidate, you know, who I am as a person, what are my values? And, you know, that's great. And we need to hear that type of information. But, you know, research shows us that it's those negative messages that elicit fear and anger. Those are the ones that are sticking with us and that are informing our decisions on election day.
And then Rick's other point was the importance of the Supreme Court. Now, elections for senators, U.S. senators, they're the ones who confirm or decline to confirm Supreme Court appointees. This seems like it comes up as a bigger issue for presidential elections because the president nominates them. Do you see it as a driving issue, Christina, in an election for a Senate seat?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's an increasing phenomenon in American politics and elections known as this idea of the nationalization of elections. So, you know, when Wisconsin voters are going to vote for, you know, cast a vote between Ron Johnson or Mandela Barnes, it doesn't just have stakes for what's going on in Wisconsin and Wisconsin politics. There's national stakes here. And, you know, we're seeing increasingly election after election, voters and donors from other states are increasingly giving to races happening in states that they don't reside in. And the stakes are high. And when you juxtapose this with the incredible amount of divisiveness that we have in American politics, you know, you've got politicians who are running on essentially national campaigns, and the stakes are higher than ever. And the Supreme Court is a major function and feature of the campaign advertisements and messages that we see.
Thanks for that call, Rick. We're talking about big spending on political ads in the 2022 midterm elections, especially here in Wisconsin. Christina LaPlante is our guest, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about political ads? Do you feel like they're all you're seeing when you watch, say, a streaming TV show or YouTube video or broadcast TV show or sporting event? Have things changed? Are you finding them disillusioning? Do you want to see changes in the way campaigns are financed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about big spending on political ads this year. Christina LaPlante is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your observations, if you're seeing lots of ads or taking careful measures to avoid them, your thoughts on how we pay for political campaigns in this country. Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mitchell is with us in North America. I guess we didn't narrow that down. Mitchell, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. Hi, Christina. Thanks for having me on. I'm actually in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Up by Superior. And I just wanted to say that I think that a reform of the political ads and how we deal with them would be great. If we could somehow equalize all of the airtime and maybe use tax revenues to give equal opportunity to each of the candidates in all of the races, that would be, I think, a decent idea in my mind.
Interesting.
And I don't know if that would necessarily change anything, but keep at least the parameters for the advertisements to only how they feel on the issues.
Mitchell, thanks for that call. Now, Christina, I know some states and communities have experimented with public financing, court challenges there. I know some countries, Israel leaps to mind, where there is that sort of, we're going to give all the candidates X amount of equal time on broadcast. At least it used to be that way. What do you think of those ideas Mitchell brought up?
Beautiful points, first of all. And, you know, we've experimented with this in American politics, you know, equal time and you know, creating standards for major media networks to, you know, give everyone a fair shot to have an opportunity to express, you know, their viewpoints, their campaigns, be heard by the American voters. But, you know, there's a lot more things that we could do, I think, on a bigger scale that other countries are doing. You know, in fact, the United States is a minority when we look at the way that ads are regulated. Most democracies have vast amounts of regulations on what you can say in your advertisements, for instance, having rules about, you know, your ads need to predominantly focus on policy, not, you know, baseless mudslinging attacks on your opponent. So, I mean, there's lots of things that can be done. And we see that being done quite well in other countries. But again, you mentioned the, you know, First Amendment kind of at the beginning here. And I think that that's the major obstacle, you know, chipping away at those First Amendment rights. And, you know, how do we walk this tightrope of, you know, holding politicians accountable, having government regulations on the content of politicians' messaging, and balancing that all with the First Amendment, which is so coveted in our society.
Mitchell, thanks for that call. Catherine joins us next in Random Lake. Catherine, hi.
Hi. First off, I don't have a television, so happily my blood pressure stays low this time of the year. And then along with that freedom of speech should not cover lies and half-truths. And I think before these ads go on the air, they should have to pass through some sort of mustard that says they're truthful ads. Maybe then we would get a few more ads that talk about policy instead of just slinging mud.
Catherine, thanks a lot for that call. Christina, my understanding of the state of regulation or non-regulation of ads is, like, I could literally say in a campaign ad, my opponent is a literal non-metaphorical werewolf. Like, I can say anything I want, right? And there's no real check on that because of the political speech element here.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the bottom line here is that what we say in campaign advertisements are just fundamentally unregulated. And I see, you know, people reacting to that. And you look at public opinion polls, and it's remarkable that, you know, most Americans, I don't have the figure right off the top of my head, but quite a significant number of Americans don't believe what they see in campaign advertisements. As some of the callers have alluded to already, we're sick and tired of the negative discourse that emanates from all of the negative attack advertisements, and people are fed up. But nonetheless, we continue to see this be a major cornerstone of American campaigns. And it really just boils down, I think, to effective leadership and ethics and reintroducing that into the political narrative and holding our politicians accountable. And, you know, there is some, I think, responsibility on behalf of the voters, at least, to say, you know, we're tired of this messaging and we're going to hold you accountable.
The tricky thing there, though, is if my candidate's doing it and their candidate's doing the same thing, I can't hold them both accountable. So I'll just end up voting for my candidate and maybe hold my nose if I didn't like their dirty ads.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this requires systemic shifts happening all throughout American politics. And you're right. You know, if your opponent is going negative and you take the high road, like we said earlier, you know, those messages aren't going to stick with voters. You're not energizing or exciting people or scaring them into voting. So, I mean, in many ways, it is a catch-22.
We're talking to Christina LaPlante from UW La Crosse, looking at big money in American politics and Wisconsin politics, for that matter, and lots of campaign ads. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us now in Northern Illinois. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? Great to hear your voice.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Paul?
I think it's really aligned with everything that we're talking about. I guess the thing here is, since we know that our governance is really a capitalist function and we want money to run it because we elected to do so, how could we, since the average citizen agrees with everything we're saying here, doesn't want money in politics, we want governance of our country, not fundraising, because that's what we spend most of our time doing. How do we get Congress to govern themselves like in so many other fashions rather than just say, well, it's my vote, since I don't have anyone to vote for who's not playing the game.
Paul, thanks for the call. What do you think, Christina?
I mean, it's absolutely a huge hurdle. You know, we've spent so much time talking about, you know, big money, big interest, really dictating the rules of the game, who runs for office, the law of the land. I mean, there are huge obstacles here. And you know, there have been some pretty progressive proposals, you know, maybe ballot initiatives across, you know, the 50 states. And let's get a constitutional amendment about, you know, regulating campaigns, regulating elections, and, you know, making it more fair and kind of putting that power back into the hands of the people. Lots of different ways of achieving this. But again, it's going to require a massive kind of groundswell grassroots movement to, I think, unfortunately, really change things and combat these ultra wealthy special interests that have grown to dominate much of American politics.
Thanks for that call. All right, I got a big question, Christina, and I'm guessing there's a lively debate on this. Are political ads, especially the negative ads, I guess, bad in some way for our system of represented government?
Well, I mean, we can use negative advertisements to certainly hold politicians accountable, to educate voters about, you know, any number of things, you know, questionable personal, professional background, things that, you know, voters are entitled to know. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that, you know, these negative advertisements, the negativity that's kind of inherent in our society and our politics, you look at public opinion data that people are increasingly cutting off family members because they don't share their same ideological positions. Or they don't vote for the same candidates. You know, we're not hanging out with people who have different partisan allegiances than we do. And that's a big problem. And that is, you know, one of the primary factors that divides us and keeps us divided. So, I mean, yeah, I think you could certainly argue that there's a time and place for negative advertisements. But, you know, when you're looking at the breakdown at the end of an election, 80 to 90% of the ad content was, you know, baseless, negative, fear-mongering attacks on your opponent. I mean, I think we need to put those two things into perspective there.
I want to take our last minute, Christina. Can you sit down with a voter here and say, okay, here's how to cut through the noise and the negativity and, you know, make an informed decision about which candidate to support in an election? What kind of advice would you give?
I'm so glad that you asked that. That's actually something that I talk with my students a lot about quite a lot. I'm actually teaching a course on campaigns and elections right now, and we are getting ready to analyze campaign messages and strategies and advertisements. And before we begin that content, I sit with them and I tell you, you know, I want you to pay attention to the messages that you receive from candidates, the messages that you hear from politicians. And I want you to kind of sit with that reaction after you hear any type of communications from a politician and ask yourself, what is this communication trying to make me feel? Is it trying to make me feel angry? If so, at what? Is it trying to make me feel afraid? If so, at whom? And sit with those feelings and think about what the motivation underlying that communication must be. And having an awareness of when our emotions are trying to be manipulated, and having the resources we need to identify that and not be so vulnerable to the emotions that are elicited in these messages.
Christina, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Christina LaPlante, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. We talked to her today about big money being spent on the midterm elections, including one tracker's ranking of the races for governor and senator in Wisconsin among the top spending in the country. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Temple Grandin joins the show for a look inside the minds of people who think in pictures instead of words and her new book, Visual Thinking. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.